In this episode, I sit down with my friend David Stearns. David is the co-director of the Nelson Nash Institute and the president of Infinite Banking Concepts, LLC. We had a lovely discussion on the recent $8.5 million IUL lawsuit, Indexed Universal Life Insurance. We also discussed the Institute's position on Universal Life and Nelson's specific comments concerning Indexed Universal Life, VUL, Variable Universal Life, and Universal Life. We had fun doing so and hope you enjoy listening. Thank you.
Why do you think Nelson hated, and I'm going to say that hated because that's what he did, hated the variable products and the universal life products. And so why did he personally hate those going back to the 1980s, even before the IVC implementation started?
Well, I sure don't pretend to speak for Nelson Nash, but I think I have a pretty good idea.
Okay. Well, I think, yeah,
that's what I'm thinking. Some of the reasons that he disliked variable products. If you consider his background, right, first purchase of a policy when he was 13, his daddy purchased it, right, gave it to him at age 14. He said, here, boy, this is yours. Yeah. He had been buying dividend paying whole life insurance for many years before he became an agent in 1963. Okay. And he even financed things, right, without really realizing until the 80s of what kind of power that really could be for someone. And then to put some perspective on that, you know, if you're paying life insurance premiums all of those years, you're going to accumulate a very respectable amount of cash value, and whole life insurance has a loan provision that you can borrow against that cash value, right? Okay. So he gets into the life insurance business in 1963, and, you know, and his brother was in there, and all of this is in his works. But here you are in the life insurance business, you've owned life insurance, you've purchased life insurance, and you understand the idea and the concept of mutuality. If I buy a policy from a whole life insurance company, I am part owner of that company, right? And it has the guarantees that it has. The cash values have the guarantees. But then there's the non-guaranteed component because it's a mutual company in the form of a dividend. Right. And if you think about that, if I'm an ownership position of a country, of a company, I want it to be profitable, you know, so I'm not going to go out and do a bunch of nefarious things. And that dividend is the financial experience of that life insurance company over a given year. Okay. And just the idea of mutuality, the guaranteed components of life insurance, and then bringing in the element and understanding the idea of mutuality and the dividend, what it means to the policyholder. And then you're in business. Right. You're in the life insurance business. And then the life insurance companies, it really began in the late 70s and it carried throughout the 80s. This idea of demutualizing, you know, with Equitable Life Assurance Society. Right. Yep. So they demutualize and AXA buys them, a French company. And it takes that ownership position away. You go from a mutual company, an ownership position as a policy owner, to just now you're just a policy holder, right? If you want to buy ownership in the company, you have to go buy their stock.
Right.
So, okay. And then when the companies demutualize, and I'm not disparaging, putting morality right, wrong, or indifferent, but the facts are, the mutual company presidents back then, when they demutualized, they got a heavy payout. They benefited more, in my opinion, than the policyholder. And we can bring that right up to date with Ohio National, and I'm not trying to blow up names out there, but if you look at when Ohio National demutualized, who the characters in the play were and what the outcome to each of the characters was, it was the policyholders that came out on the short end of the stick. So Nelson understand this is, I don't want to go on and on, but the idea of a demutualization, right? And then the, you know, Harvard MBA from the outside coming in, going to solve all the problems of the life insurance company. Oh, well, we'll demutualize, turn into stock, and then we'll create all of these products, right? VUL, bring in the idea of the investment type return, with Variable Universal Life. But then, but it didn't start there. It started with Universal Life, you know, Ralph Nader and all of those characters. Well, interest rates were very high. And so it's easy to show a side fund, right, that has a high interest rate. And then, and this is the structure of all universal life, some kind of a side fund to earn an interest rate to create a growth element of the account values and the death benefit, right? And then you got Ralph Nader coming in saying, this is too complicated. Whole life is too complicated to understand for the consumer. And then the universal life, while they're demutualizing, trying to be all things to all people, they acquiesce to that. And that was their result. That was their delivering of a product that could, quote unquote, be unbundled. Whole life. Yeah. And Nelson talks about this very briefly. He gets it done in a much briefer time period than I do. You cannot unbundle whole life insurance. Right, so I think a culmination of those, his history with dividend paying whole life insurance.
There's nothing to unbundle, you know.
There's nothing to unbundle, and it's really not complicated. Yeah. The cash value in 1963, the cash value must equal the face amount at age 100. Yeah. That's the growth rate of cash value. You can look back and
you can't,
Yeah, you can look back and put a rate of return on it. Well, and today, now the theoretical life expectancy is age 120. So the cash value must equal the face amount at age 120. And that is going to happen at any time in the future. You can look back and say, oh, well, here's the internal rate of return on the cash value. Oh, and look, you could have earned more elsewhere or whatever the arguments are. You know, I'll take a breath so you can speak, sir.
Take a breath. You talked about Ralph Nader. You know, 1979, he got on the horse, or you know, consumer advocate extraordinaire. You know, congressional hearings and whatnot, throwing the life insurance industry under the bus because they were fleecing the American public and charging them extremely high premium rates for a smaller death benefit. Okay,
that was the accusation. Yeah,
it's accusation. So it's like, you know, why do that? Just buy a term policy and you get the same death benefit for 1/10 the premium. I'm guessing 1/10. Okay, so don't throw me under the bus with that one. So that started that rubric that's so prevalent today by our favorite financial gurus and whatnot. Buy a term, invest the difference, which opened the door for Wall Street to package all these qualified plans to provide something simple and easy to understand for the public to invest the difference in, right? Of course, we say qualified plan, you're talking about the federal government, you're talking about tax-deferred accounts, and all that money is now going into mutual funds, right? And
they who's making the money on that? They created the Keogh plan, I believe, in 1980. Right, the Keogh plan, the 401k.
Yeah, the ERISA years. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, of course, if you're not going to, in if the truth be told, and if there's a student of history with any kind of, you know, honest analysis, most people that's where they put money. They bought life insurance. It created an immediate estate if you died early. Right. And then it created a cash value that's going to equal the face amount. You know, in the future, it's going to be a very high number whenever you reach passive income time. Right. So people, it was historically habitual for people to buy life insurance. And then the mutual funds didn't even come out until 1930. Right. And then you go forward and then, you know, Nelson talks about this in the pension idea in several places, the idea of a pension. Right. And then the qualified plans of government. Oh, what will solve a problem? Nothing faster than the government getting involved. Right. America's not saving enough money. We love them. We want to give them a benefit to save money in a qualified plan. Oh, yeah, and he talks about that as well. But, you know, it is a timing thing. You have Ralph Nader coming. You know, you have A.L. Williams, coach, all these gurus coming and say, oh, term, you know, they reduced the characteristics of dividend-paying whole life insurance, which they didn't understand and still don't to this day, in my humble opinion, down to one finite point, the cost of the death benefit, premium versus death benefit. Of course, the premium is cheaper on term than it is on permanent insurance. There's no question about that.
Well, it wouldn't be cheaper if you designed the policy a term L120 term policy. Guess what? Death benefit would be the same.
Yeah, that's just it. Then you're looking at a time period. They had annual renewable term, and it was guaranteed renewable, you know, past age 65 or 70 or up into these ages. Yeah, nobody keeps a term at age 90, right? If I bought a 30-year term at age 30, but I kept paying the higher and higher premium when I turned 60 because the premium goes up every year, the premium has an exponential curve to it, the cost of the death benefit, which exists in universal life, the exponential cost of the death benefit. If we're on camera, I guess I should go that way. The cost of insurance is what it's called in universal life, goes up every year. Well, it's minuscule when you're a child or when you're young and healthy in your 30s and 40s. It starts creeping up in your 50s, and then it advances even faster, exponential, in your 60s. It goes vertical in your 70s, and no one is going to continue to pay those premiums. Very few people do. I say no one. Somebody might. Most people do not.
Well,
and then, you know, Nelson ran illustrations, right? He says it is, but he ran illustrations, and he never sold one, and he certainly would never buy one because he's seen, you could see it's actuarial. It's going to happen. What's going to happen? The death benefit is going to be reduced. The account values are going to be depleted if you live long enough, right, to the universal life. That's by design. But it was, you know, the life insurance industry is like, we want to be all things to all people. We're getting beat up in the media. You know, everybody loves the market, mutual funds. And so, okay, let's create these products. Interest rates are high. And besides, I'm going to get a big payout when I demutualize, and I'm going to be retired by the time these policies are.
Well, yeah, going back to the demutualization, you know, I think that a lot of the companies, they thought they couldn't compete now based upon the negative press. And so they needed to raise capital, and they couldn't. And their life insurance sales dropped precipitously from like 86% of total sales to like, I don't know, 40% maybe, I don't know. But so how do they raise money? Well, they demutualize, and now they can still sell stocks, and they can offer products that will entice them, you know, to be more transparent, like you said, with other financial products, and raise more money by selling more product. Okay. And then, of course, I never understood the ceiling floor aspect of the side funds, and how you can pay out more when the insurance company's general portfolio is at 6% on an average. I mean, you're guaranteeing 8 to 10% payouts to clients on the side fund. I mean, where does that money come from?
Well, back in the day when they're that high of guarantees, the money markets and the CDs were paying 12 and 14%. That doesn't exist today. You know, there's it just doesn't exist, so they can't. And I would say that, you know, the universal life interest rates were high on CDs. That was in the 80s, right? Then comes the 90s with the variable universal life. And so they just took mutual funds, in essence, called them sub-accounts, and wrapped the life insurance policy around that, right? So you have the cost of term in the VUL, variable universal life, and the side fund was sub-accounts, many mutual funds. And so, you know, the market looked good for most of the time period in the 90s, you know, until it didn't, right? And then those sales kind of faltered. And then they developed the equity indexed universal life product in the late 1998, 97, 98, 99, 2000, somewhere around there. And so now it's like, oh, now we're going to use an outside index, right? So we can go create our own, and we can do this quote unquote back testing that shows the last 10 years, the last 20 years of a high interest earning period, an average, and then a low interest. And then they're not on the risk The life insurance company is not on the risk. All universal life policies, all of them, 100% of them, shift the risk to the policyholder. Well, how do you say that, James? It's not market risk, not the market risk, right? The potential loss of an investment, you know, because we have floors, right, in the index universal life. Well, here we're going to, you get to choose between these different indices, and the floor will be zero. We're going to track it each year, every 2 years, every 3 years, or whatever it is. And when the markets go up, you know, you could be credited a part of that, right, as an interest rate credit at the end of a time period, at the end of the year. But if the market ever goes down, it's a zero. So it's marketed as, oh, you can't lose money. Well, you don't lose money in the market because your money was never in the market. But when you understand the construct of a universal life policy, if I pay a $10,000 premium, as an example, to an indexed universal life policy, I pay $10,000. Well, what comes out of that? All of the fees, you know, the policy fee, the excess fee, 6% a month. And these companies have almost made up fees, made up names for these fees. But there's a policy fee, there's a mortality fee, there's an excess fee. And after all those fees come out, then that remainder gets applied to an index. Okay? And then the index credits what it credits. And who controls the cap of these indices, right? It's a life insurance company. So whether it's uncapped, you know, if the market returned 30%, you know, you would get credited 30%. Well, and that may be possible in the first year or two, but the caps always come down, always, always. And this is not to be confused with indexed annuities. I'm just making a point here. An index, and I don't love or hate them. They are what they are. But the indexed annuity doesn't have the built-in increasing cost of the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. And so
it's a reverse of insurance. Yeah,
if
policy.
I have no interest rate credit, let's say the fees in the early years were only $1,000. I paid a $10,000 premium and all the fees were $1,000. So $9,000 was indexed to some index, right? And it earned an interest rate and I was credited. Perfect. Well, maybe the next year the market's down 9%. I didn't lose any money because of the market drop, because my money's not in the market. It's just allocated to an index. And so there's no interest credit, but the fees went up. So, yeah, there's no market risk to a universal life unless you're in a VUL, then that's an equity product, right? Okay, so there's no market risk. So what is this risk that's being transferred to the owner? What is this? It's the risk that the policy will be enforced the day you graduate. The probability that the longer you live, the higher the probability is that that policy will not be enforced. And it won't be enforced. If it is enforced, it won't be enforced the way it was illustrated. Right. Well, and then you can make the same argument with whole life insurance. You know, we're building life insurance illustrations. That's part of the industry, right? And to educate the consumer, to give them an idea of what could happen in the future if you pay these premiums and the life insurance company is this profitable and pays a dividend and you have the dividend paid into the paid up additions. This is what could happen in the future. So it's an illustrative industry that we're in. Right. But the difference is in the illustration. Very distinct, very important. The illustrations on a universal life insurance policy is looking backwards to saying here's the last 10 years of a really high experience in the indices. Here's a moderate and here's a negative. And they're projecting that forward. Where the illustration on a dividend paying whole life insurance policy is based on right now. This is what dividend we're paying because the dividend that we declared is representative of our financial experience over the last year. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Totally different.
Yeah.
All right. And then, I'll take a breath. I'm sorry.
In reality, there is no cash surrender value in an IUL.
Well, it depends on when you surrender. Let's talk about that. The surrender charges, and all IUL has them, they'll go from a minimum of 7 years all the way up for 18 years. Think about that. Now, there's a loss of liquidity in dividend-paying whole life insurance. Nelson calls it the startup period. You know, and that has spawned a bunch of contention within the industry. You know, and then the design, trying to be liquid or whole or, you know, as early as possible, which speaks to structure, right? Anyway, so there's not per se a surrender charge on a whole life insurance policy. There's not. If I paid in X number of premium dollars and there's X number of cash value and I leave early, you know, I get mad and quit, there's a loss, but it's not a surrender charge. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a loss. It's a loss. Now, if I hold that, you know, long enough, and typically it doesn't take long, 5, 7, 8 years, whatever, at least I can walk away whole, even if the life insurance company lowers their dividend. You know, we might be in a high dividend interest period right now, and it could go down. I mean, it's a matter of time. I can look out into the future and see, as long as I pay the premium and the company pays, you know, an honest or moderate dividend at least, it's just a matter of time before I get mad and quit and I can walk away whole. There's no capital loss. There's only the loss of the time value of money. Well, I could have earned something more elsewhere. And let's be clear about that. You can't lose anything that you've never had. And that's a mere calculation. This idea of opportunity cost, it's a concept. I love it. I teach it. I think I understand it. It's nothing but a calculation.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. There's no money there. It's just a it's a projection of what could happen. Yeah.
Yeah. If I spoke on the illustration, and there's a place for illustrations, you know, if I'm going to make an investment, I'm going to see projections from the investment company, and it's going to be historical, right, with all the disclosures. If I'm going to enter into a business deal, they're going to create an EBITDA, and it's like, well, you know, if all of our expectations are right, this is what the projected rate of return is, right? With a life insurance policy, expressly a dividend paying whole life insurance policy, they're not looking back. You know, we can talk about the history of life insurance and how these companies have been in business over 100 years and never failed to pay a dividend. And there's history there. There's no question. But the illustration is not looking back. It's saying right now, if nothing changes, and we know everything's going to change, dividends are going to go up and they're going to go down, right? And we look forward, this is what a reasonable expectation is. I mean, I think it's critically important to understand an illustration. But I also think it's critically important to understand what you're putting your money into. If you're going to buy whole life insurance or anything, you're going to make any type of investment. And life insurance is not an investment. That's a whole nother conversation, right? You should have at least a fundamental understanding of what you're putting your money in. And it's not complicated. You don't have to be a life insurance expert. Right. But to have a rudimentary understanding of here's my premium and I can either go up or down with very limited and can, you know, that's very limited. And if the company is a decent company and they pay a dividend and they have a history of paying dividends and they have a history of being profitable, there's a reasonable expectation of these dividends to be paid in the future. Okay. And here's what it is. Well, then you compare that. Because this industry is illustrative, like, overload. When it comes to IUL, all UL, that is a illustration sale and an illustration purchase. Somebody is trying to get a greater rate of return. And then on an illustration, the IULs are always going to out illustrate a whole life policy because one lives in reality and one doesn't. And it's too illustrative or illustration
dependent. That sounds like a scheme to me if I hear something like that. You know,
it sounds like it's what?
That's a scheme. It's illicit.
A lot of people buying something on
a projection. Of course, you do have this. You do have the notes saying, you know, this is not guaranteed. Performance could be greater or less. You know, investments are, you know, taken at your own risk. right?
Yeah, future performances, so past performances, no guarantee of future performance.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever written one of those in any of the policies that I've bought. But anyway, so I guess where I'm going here is, like, you know, the infinite banking concept is about solving a problem. You know, getting the bankers out of your life, becoming your own banker. So the only way to do that is to replicate a bank, having capital used as collateral for loans from a mutual insurance company at a set or variable interest rate, loan rates. And so you control the cash flow. You control the need. Your need for capital is based upon you, not the insurance company. Okay. You borrow what you need. You pay back at a rate that covers the insurance company interest rate, but you can, if you design the policy correctly, you can probably put additional premium in the policy as you repay these loans and grow it even more than illustrated initially. And so the whole life product is more desirable because it's what? Stable, it's predictable, it's guaranteed, it's contractual. You, as long as you pay a base premium, there's no risk to you to losing your death benefit. You know, but the important part from Nelson's perspective is that you've taken the bankers out of your life. You're controlling the banking equation, and you're growing capital in the process of doing that. Not to mention the death benefit. Not to mention the generational wealth transfer aspect of everything that comes intrinsically with the whole life insurance contracts, and also, you know, not just death benefit, but, you know, policy ownership, right? There's all kinds of benefits in that thing. So, you know, there's a lot of noise out there about, you know, infinite banking as Nelson designed it and discovered it, and as we promote it, the Nelson Nash Institute is passe. It's old school. There's better, more exciting, higher rate of return products out there that perform even better if you use them in the infinite banking concept world. So tell me, how would an IUL benefit from being used as a privatized bank? What benefit would that have? The additional funding you put in there would support the increased premiums? Would support, you know, what would be the benefit of using an IUL as a banking vehicle?
Okay, so I'm a little jaded here. I mean, and you said a lot.
Well, I'm just thinking from the ulterior perspective. There's a bunch of gurus out there, and I got one guy in mind now, who's like made his living on this, on using the IUL for everything, including IBC. So I just don't understand why an IUL would be a better platform for infinite banking, even though we've already discussed it illustrates better than a permanent product, a whole life product. Why would it be better for IBC?
It would not. Simply put, it would not. It is not better. It's not even as good.
What's their argument then?
Their argument is solely based on rate of return. I can get a higher rate of return with Universal Life because I'm exposed to these indices. You know, the S&P returns, you know, whatever the average is, 9 to 11%, 7 to 9% over the last 30 years without dividends. That is the presentation. That is the sell. And that is the purchase of an IUL policy, is a greater rate of return. And if you look at the now, can you bank, quote unquote, bank with an IUL policy? Yes. Yes. I mean, we've talked many times you can bank with anything. Mm-hmm. Why? Because Universal Life has a loan provision. Okay. It's a life insurance contract. It has a loan provision. And if you look at, just for terminology, you know, you mentioned the base premium, and I believe it's on page 38. Nelson really does a very eloquent, and I believe simplicity is a virtue, right? Education on proper structure of a life insurance policy. Page 38, Becoming Your Own Banker, 5th edition. And, you know, we talked the other day, you know, page 39 is Nelson's thoughts on IUL and VUL. And it's very simple, very clear. You know, after you read his thoughts on IUL and VUL, just go ahead and turn your eyes left and look at what's on page 38. Okay. Yep. And so, just for terminology, if I buy a universal life policy, there's what is called a target premium within the industry. That can be compared to the base premium of a whole life insurance policy. And then there's excess premium to a universal life policy. That can be compared just numerically in cash flows and premium. That can be compared to a paid up additions rider on a whole life policy, right? The dynamic PUA rider that we put on whole life policies. So if I'm going to the life insurance company and I'm going to buy an IUL, and then it, then the argument today is structured just like, what's going on in the infinite banking footprint, properly structured. That's very broad. The same argument exists today in universal life and IUL. The people that promote IUL and argue or debate against the people who don't like IUL, they say, well, they don't know how to structure. They're not structuring it correctly, right? So the argument's there. But fundamentally, the target premium is fixed on an IUL. The only movement flexibility is in the excess premium. So could I go put a bunch of money in consistently over time into an IUL policy? I'm paying premium. I'm buying a policy. I'm creating account value, right? And I'm hoping, and maybe in many years, maybe I do get a higher interest credited to me in an IUL because of these outside indices compared to a dividend paying whole life insurance policy. Okay. So I can go start an IUL. It has a loan provision. I can finance things. And if I pay quote unquote additional premium and make it additional interest, it was really quote unquote page 58, becoming your own banker. Nelson explains what that additional interest is. Can I have that paid to the excess premium of an IUL policy? Yes, I can. I can. And it can, and it could work out very well for some kind of a time period. But every year I'm having a birthday. Every year I'm getting one step closer to graduating. Every year the cost of the insurance, COI, goes up on an IUL policy. Now, if I spent a lifetime or a legitimate period of time, 20, 30, 40 years, practicing this idea, this wonderful idea that Nelson discovered, right? And I'm practicing this and I'm controlling the banking function in my life. And someday I'm going to run out of things or I'll have less things I want to finance. Maybe I'm financing my, you know, passive income in quote unquote retirement. Maybe I'm gifting money. Maybe I'm doing these things. Every year, the cost of that insurance is going up. And if I spend 30, 40, 50 years doing that, what am I going to wind up with? What am I likely going to wind up with? Much less death benefit. Right. And almost no account value. And then the structure, and I can even structure them, you know, I can structure a UL policy 90-10, have 10% to the target, 90% to the excess, right? And I'm still going to wind up in a lesser position compared to straightforward dividend paying whole life that's structured appropriately or properly, that's an individual. I know that's a broad term, structure, properly structured, but it's individual. It's customized to the client and their needs and their duration, their life expectancy. Why would I spend 30 years and then not going to have what I expected? Or maybe I wind up with a tax problem. I don't have the income. I have less income than what was projected. And maybe that, and there's a MEC problem, a tax future in my future. It's like, yeah, no. And so I don't know if that helps, but yes, you can bank with a universal life policy. You do it long enough, the results are going to be the same or worse.
Yeah.
Right? Well, because structure, not the structure, but because of the design of the index universal life policy.
Yeah, I guess what I was asking was, if a universal life product is a term policy with a side fund. So the collateral is a side fund?
Yes.
And so,
well, actually, yeah, I mean, that's the numerical value. But when you borrow against any life insurance policy, the whole policy is collateralized. All the rights and privileges of an owner, all of the entire policy is collateralized. Okay.
Yeah.
But that's a limit. That's a numerical limit, right? There's an account value, there's a cash value, and there's a limit on what you can borrow as far as dollars. So,
yeah. So, yeah, as long as the policy is in force, the policy is still yours. So if the side fund is the basis for the amount of the loan, okay, so is the money come out? Where does the loan money come from?
The general revenue fund of the life insurance company. Now, every policy may act a little different. You know, like in the whole life world, some companies are direct recognition, non-direct recognition, so you don't get a dividend on the outstanding loan, and there's a big argument about that. Mm-hmm. The same applies with universal life. Maybe you don't get the full interest credit, or maybe you get a minimum interest credit, right, to the excess. So there's variations between companies. I just think the fundamental problem is the design of the policy. I don't care how somebody, an agent, a professional, you know, tries to construct against the eventual probability of that policy cannibalizing itself, you know, reducing the target premium. They can massage that policy however they want to. It's not the solution, because you can't correct something that's flawed by design
from the beginning. Yeah. Yep. So, you know, I asked you to have this discussion with me because, you know, there's been a lot of negative press recently about the IUL product, you know, lawsuits and whatnot. And, you know, going back to the Ralph Nader thing in 79, you know, the life insurance industry took it on the chin for, you know, his, you know, Nader's accusations about, you know, that the public's being cheated. They're paying high premiums for low death benefits, and the insurance company knew that, and this, that, this, that, this, that. So no matter what product is out there, what one company's doing versus another company, the whole industry got a black eye, right?
Yeah.
And so my concern was that this IUL lawsuit in the press, the public would just basically think the life insurance industry as a whole were selling these products, and that the whole industry would be ostracized, and more money would flow out of the life insurance coffers, mutual companies, mutual holding companies, stockholder companies, regardless, and go elsewhere like the Wall Street. So, you know, that's why I asked you to talk, so we could understand what the IUL was and why Nelson didn't like these variable products, and why the permanent product was, I keep saying permanent product, you know, I guess the IUL is a permanent product, but I'm talking about the whole life product, was designed correctly and it was not flawed, and why the Nelson Nash Institute forbids or authorized IBC practitioners from selling any kind of product other than the permanent whole life product to their clients that believe in the IBC and want to implement the infinite banking concept strategies using life insurance products as the platform for implementation for privatized banking. So I just want to I wanted to be clear about why we do that, why that's our position, and we did this past week, we published a position paper, a statement stating that and why, and if you want to find it, it's on our website, okay? We also email it to all our subscribers, you know, about 5,000 or 6,000 people. So, I mean, I think it's important that we clear the air and the public understands what our position is at the Nelson Nash Institute. Of course, James is one of our longstanding practitioners. I think you were the first one, now that I think about it. Congratulations.
Thank you. 001, I'm very, very proud of that.
Nelson. 007 is a better number, though. So.
Well, you know, I'm not a spy, so. Obviously, I'm a subscriber, and I thought the position statement was good. So I appreciate you putting that out there.
Well, we got a lot of positive feedback from that, and it was really good. And I hope there was no surprises. Okay. when folks read that, because, you know, if somebody wants to enroll in our course, our practitioner course, then the first step is actually submitting a signed practitioner agreement to us, which we don't exercise and countersign until that individual is enrolled in our course. But that's that practitioner agreement, and anybody can find it on our website under the training page under the practitioner program. That agreement is pretty clear covering what I just said. And so somebody who signs that agreement and doesn't read it, then shame on them, right?
Yeah, but, no question. You know, if I can just take a quick side note.
Go ahead.
You know, and I'm proud to be 001, but that was in 2013 or 2012 that NNI actually took form.
Yeah, we developed the program in 2012. We started the process in June of 2012, and we rolled out the program at the think tank in February of 2013.
Perfect. I think the record.
Yeah, that first year, I think we had 99 or 100 attendees at the think tank actually sign up for the program at the think tank. We rolled it out. So, and you, of course, James, you're
like the record to show that my relationship with Nelson doesn't go back as far as yours. I didn't have the opportunity to meet Ken when we were young. You know, I met my lovely wife, Jana. But my relationship goes back to 2005 with Nelson Nash. So, and I'm saying that because it's true, but I have always been a supporter of the Nelson Nash Institute. I am currently, and I always will be. So I appreciate you, your efforts, and what you have to deal with, the public and the agents. You know, it's not an easy task. And so I'm thankful and appreciative that you're there doing what you do. So thank you.
Well, there's a lot of moving parts, obviously. You know, you got to deal with people. That's number one. You got to deal with individuals. And you know, one of the strategies for when we developed the training program, the IBC training program, was to monetize the message. Okay, like, you know, Nelson was a fundamental Austrian economist, just like you are. And he believed in the Austrian school of thought versus the Keynesian group. But he was kept knocking his head against the wall, trying to get the Mises and Fee and Rutherford and Acton and all these think tanks to actually understand, you know, what privatized banking actually looked like and what were the simple steps to implement them. You know, they thought it was just about selling life insurance. So they wouldn't touch it. And so that was really frustrating for Nelson and for us. And so, you know, Carlos and, you know, had the idea, well, why don't we monetize the message? And by monetize the message, one of the core principles in the training program that we support here, the practitioner program, is the Austrian school of thought and how that relates directly to the infinite banking concept. Okay. And so how do you monetize it? Well, agents who understand the relationship of Austrian economics, capital theory, and privatized banking it'll make them easier for them to show their clients and prospects that these whole life policies are great places to start off with to do that. And the monetization is that they'll make money selling life insurance, right? So that was the fundamental basis of the training program. That's what we did. Instead of saying, hey, listen, here's a training program. This is how you design a policy. This is how you sell a policy. Move on to the next person. Check the box. No, it's about fundamentally changing the thought process of a civilian, general public, on how they can really control the banking function and, quote unquote, slay the snakes and dragons.
You know, I appreciate you saying that, but, you know, there's and two, and I think we spoke last week, you know, to talk about this that's going on in the news. I think just like the Austrians have had a struggle, a hard time understanding or embracing this idea of becoming your own banker because it uses life insurance, it speaks to the how life insurance in the industry has been characterized. You know, going way back to 79 and even in the earlier 70s, you know, they didn't even have an adequate defense when the MEC laws came about in the 80s. I mean, so my point is, who's surprised that, number one, this particular case is generating all of the news media, high profile individual suing a universal life insurance company, a company that was a mutual company at one time, and I'm quite sure they demutualized. You know, so you got high profile. The media is not going to differentiate anything in the life insurance industry. They are not going to differentiate between universal life or whole life at all. They haven't, and they're not going to change. So who's surprised? You know, the only surprise to me was maybe the volume of the premium and the allegations of the amount of loss, and that's all for – that'll all be determined, you know, through that legal process. But I think that – and I'm concerned, you know – two, that life insurance is receives such bad press, right? Whoever's behind the press, you know, whether it's Wall Street or whatever. But if the Austrians can't get it, if you look at Mises wrote about life insurance in one of the books, I don't remember which one, but I can't be surprised if the media doesn't just continue to jump on the bandwagon and saying, oh, life insurance is bad. It all works the same. Every licensed life insurance agent is nothing more than a commission hound, and it's a bad product, you know? And so, I think that's very important. The work that you do, the mere fact that the Nelson Nash Institute exists, I think, there's a very broad front, and we have to continue to spread the message that the banking function can be controlled at the you and me level, and dividend paying whole life insurance has all the characteristics of a lending institution or a lending structure. The structure that allows somebody to control the banking function. People don't know that. They hear what they hear, right, in media and what have you. And Nelson said it many times, most people's understanding of life insurance is based on someone else's misconception. I mean, the life insurance companies didn't come up with this idea of controlling the banking function. They probably begrudgingly, but they put a loan provision in the policies hundreds of years, 100 years ago, just to keep the policies in force, right?
Right.
So it's not like they're –
Yeah,
but they didn't come up with this concept. So they oftentimes have difficulty in understanding the true power of controlling the banking function, even in their individual lives. Some have got it, many more are getting it, and they understand. But what does that say when the whole industry doesn't really understand the power of their product? You know?
It's frustrating. It is. And just by the virtue of the demutualization, that shows their lack of understanding. Okay.
Yeah.
And, you know, I found it intriguing. We talked about Austrian economic theory versus Keynesian theory. You know, Keynes was once in the insurance industry in England, right? And what did he do to the industry there? He destroyed
good.
It. He destroyed it. I don't want to go down that black hole, but it's,
well, we can go down another time, you know.
We can do a short video on the history of life insurance. And it originated in London and it died in London. So at least from the London perspective. But anyway,
let me say this if I could, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we spoke last week, you know, and I've read the article, you know, the media releases, and I've also gotten the 50-page complaint. I think that's worthy of every insurance agent advisor reading that. You know, I think it's relevant, right? How the industry, not the life insurance industry, but how the life insurance industry is viewed by the general public. Okay, but since last week, you know, in your release from the Nelson Nash Institute, you put it all right there, made it really easy for guys like me, David, and I really appreciate it. Now, Nelson speaks about universal life on page 39, and I said earlier, mm-hmm. while they're on page 39, the reader, if they would just look left, if they had a printed book, it'd be great. And just spend some time on page 38. And then chapter 9 out of Building Your Warehouse of Wealth, right? He has his words, and then he introduces.
Todd Langford helped him a lot with that chapter. Like, Todd did most of that, okay? Nelson gave him credit for that, yeah.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. And Todd Langford's a great guy, great, you know, calculators. But I had the opportunity because you also reference the IBC, the Nelson Nash Institute Practitioners Program manual, right? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, here since 2013, I'm 001, I've been there. It has been several years since I went and looked at that manual. And I'm bringing all that up for the encouragement. If you're a practitioner, you want to be a practitioner, there is really good stuff in that manual. Talks about the taxation, the structure of life insurance, and the sales it touches on. There's nothing sell. I mean, you mentioned monetizing this idea. This is not a sales manual at all.
No.
But it's also very clear that life insurance is not a tax loophole at all. So
bingo.
I'm just saying that, man, if you hadn't broke out that practitioner's manual in a minute, it's okay to go back and recap.
That's why we did the manual the way we did it. That's why it's a hard-bound, three-ring binder. So it's not just used to, okay, study it, okay, pass the test, okay, now let me go out and sell some life insurance. No, it's a reference book, okay? You know, there's, you know, and it's there to continually use as you, to overcome objections, to go back and refresh your memory about, well, how did this happen and why did it happen? You know, from a historical perspective, from an economic perspective. And then it touches upon, obviously, a lot of the key points of becoming your own banker. But yeah, it's like, it's a living document. And, Bob Murphy, you know, give him credit. He did the lion's share putting that together for us, back when he was with us. But, that's what we're all about, you know, is that manual. And Nelson was all about, you know, he's an avid reader like you are. And he firmly believed that economics and history were one and the same, you know, follow the money trail kind of thing, right? Yeah. And so you see all that sprinkled through there. But, you know, we interview anybody who wants to become a practitioner before we accept them and take their money from them. And, you know, we're not looking for, okay, are you a seasoned veteran? You know, what are your sales and life insurance last year? You know, yeah, you're a good candidate. No, it's like, do you understand who we are and what we're trying to do? Well, how we're trying to promote this to the general public. And we want people who, number one, understand it. Number two, are ethically behind what we're doing, and they'll do the right thing by their client and not sell them an IUL, by the way. But anyway, so that's it's as simple as that. It's like, well, if I join your program, am I going to get more leads?
Oh yeah, lead gen.
Okay, that's important, right?
I think that if people look at the Nelson Nash Institute, you know, go to the website, you can, it's pretty clear what the Institute's position is in the marketplace, right? It's pretty clear that, you know, you're not a, I mean, I understand you use the word monetization. I understand that, you know, yeah, a life insurance agent could potentially make some money, maybe more income compared to, you know, just being trained. There is no training in the life insurance industry. What am I talking about? You know, compared to just writing life insurance and annuities and what have you. But that doesn't, so that's not a bad thing, right? Being monetized. I'm a capitalist. I believe in capitalism and free markets. But my point is, it's pretty clear the position of the Nelson Nash Institute. It's pretty clear. And if you read Nelson's works, the two books, 6.5-hour video, DVD, available digitally, for the general public, and by all means, the practitioner should understand these materials, right? There's no question about that. But for the general public to go and be able to digitally access a 6.5-hour video of Nelson Nash himself giving a presentation on becoming your own banker, $150, $200. I don't know how much it costs, but isn't it better to, in my mind, it would be better to go to the source as to listen to some allegations from wherever they come from, whether it's in the industry, legal, financial, whatever. It's like, hear what Nelson Nash himself wrote or what he said. Read exactly what he wrote. So, and that's my encouragement, is to learn, not necessarily become an agent. You know, the life insurance industry and the life insurance business, you know, is not all glamour and it's not all money. You know, I mean, I'm not poor mouthing it or anything, but it's work, because this is what we're dealing with. People don't want to read. You know, we don't have a memory of history. You know, I think the collective memory of a society, you know, changes about every 75 years. Why are you bringing that up, James? Because who remembers Ralph Nader? Who remembers Michael Milken? Who remembers, you know, Executive Life out of California? These younger generations, you know, maybe have never heard of those. Who remembers Mutual Benefit Life? You know, and what happened to them? And why did it happen? And it was because the life insurance industry is moving away from this idea of mutuality.
Yeah.
And, you know, stepping into the idea that we can be all things to all people. We want to compete with Wall Street. We want to be all things to all people. No, that's not what this is about. This is about building capital. Talk about Austrian capital theory and business cycle theory. And if we bring in the idea of banking, right, quote unquote, this movement of money, you can't bank and you can't control the banking function without access to capital, period. Mm-hmm. So capital formation, capital accumulation comes first. What is the smartest, best way to do that? For the you and me individual, systematic, on purpose, with intent, that's predictable. And I'm not risking anything in my future, right? I'm not, you know, I'm developing discipline because we all need that. None of us have enough or too much. The systematic formation of capital. And then when you do that, and it takes discipline to do that, and then you have access, contractual access to that capital, then you can perform and control the banking function. That, sir, changes someone's financial life, or has the power to.
Right. No, that's the essence of IBC. And that's what, you know, that's why I'm so irritated with, you know, the term infinite banking, quote unquote. It's like, you know, again, it's not the industry is taking that term and flipped it upside down. It's sales people and just the general public and all these different social forms and whatnot. The infinite banking is about policy design. It's about arbitrage. It's about leveraging. It's about this. No, it's not. It's about what you just said. And so if it doesn't line up, if all those components don't line up, then it's not infinite banking. Okay. Call it what you want to call it, but infinite banking concept. Okay. Is what Nelson developed, described, and promoted, and proved that it was an effective, real financial philosophy. So that's my irritation about IBCs.
I try to, and I'm not perfect. You know, thank goodness. Y'all stone me or crucify me. Not y'all. I try to use infinite banking in the form or in reference to all of that. And that is not the infinite banking concept.
Yeah.
I try to make a distinction there.
Let me wrap up and revisit the IUL lawsuit. You know, Kyle Busch and his wife were the owners of that IUL policy that apparently went south, and they're suing the insurance company. They're probably suing the producer that sold them the product too. But you know, you talked about all these things about the older you get, the higher the mortality rate is, and the cost of insurance, and yada yada yada. Well, how is Kyle Busch is 40 years old? Okay, so I mean, how did that policy go so south so fast for a 40-year-old individual? I mean, could it have something to do with how they were funding it?
It could. I mean, and I don't know. I haven't seen. I've only read the. I don't even think I can say I thoroughly read, but I have perused quite heavily the 50-page complaint, right? And I'm not an attorney, and I know some smart ones. I don't want to be one. I don't practice law. I don't give tax advice. You know, I don't give investment advice outside of my clients because I'm an investment advisor, representative. I'm a life insurance agent is what I am. And do a lot of business consulting. There's no question about that. So I don't know how the policy was structured. I do know the allegations insinuate that it was structured for the benefit of the agent, which would be a higher target premium in the case of an IUL. I don't know if that's true or not. Have no idea. And I also know that the allegations they understood, the Bushes understood that there could be an end date to a premium payment, right? So there'd be a limited pay type situation. It doesn't say anything about premium finance, but when you get into universal life, it's quite heavily promoted with premium finance where you put assets up to borrow the money to pay the premium, and you know that works, and that illustrates very well in low interest rate environments. The outcome's never rarely pretty for the individual, the owner, the insured, rarely successful in my humble 30-year experience. And can it work? Sure. I mean, I can teach my dog to count too, right? If I spend enough time with her, you know, kind of, you know, hit your paw three times, do it 1, 2, 3. I mean, so there's a lot of things that are possible. Okay. But let me speak to this, that the, there's a lot of flamboyant marketing out there. Who knows how it was marketed? There is no contractual right, zero, to limit a premium to a universal life policy. Let me be very clear on that. There are non-forfeiture options that are guaranteed with whole life policies that do not exist in universal life. Very important, because a policy, a whole life policy, one of the non-forfeiture options, you know, to make sure that the consumer, the policyholder, has some residual remaining value. Okay, layman's terms. RPU, reduced paid up. That's a guaranteed option in a whole life policy that cannot exist and therefore does not exist in universal life policies. Can't be done. Just like a single premium life insurance policy, a whole life insurance policy. Yeah, it may be a MEC. I'm not talking about. Can I make a guaranteed premium one time? And then be guaranteed. I can't even contractually pay another premium. Right. And the policy will, it's a guarantee, right? There's some non-guaranteed elements. The dividend is non-guaranteed. But the underlying guarantee of that whole life insurance policy is it will remain in force. That, those types of guarantees don't exist, do not exist in the universal life policy. All right, so I'm just saying from reading the complaint, there was a potentially a conversation or understanding, however it was commuted, that they there might be a limited premium period. Mm-hmm. And I'm just saying contractually that can't exist in whole life. So who knows what's going on with that? We'll see the results unless they, you know, settle out of court and, you know, and have all these non-disclosures, you know.
Yeah.
But okay. So wait, let me say a couple things if you don't mind. I'll let you go. I know you're busy. You know, the opportunity, like I said earlier, you know, we're going to have this phone call. You know, I read this book and Becoming Your Own Banker all the time. It's been a minute since I, you know, perused the practitioner's manual. And I'm telling you, it's gold. Might need a facelift. Who knows in the future, whatever. There's some good stuff in there. If you're a practitioner and you haven't read it, my encouragement is to go back and read it. And then, too, and I think about this often, but the other day, I think it's chapter 12 in Building Your Warehouse of Wealth. Yeah, it's chapter 12, page 89, right? Out of Egypt onto Babylon, right? It's an essay, right? No, I think it's relevant for me. So I'm in the financial world. Right. And I'm not, I don't have any discipline. So I'm not saving money. And so, you know, and I'm aging. Man, I got to swing for the mountain. I got to hit a home run. Right. So you're going from Egypt, bondage. You're not controlling your financial world. You're not controlling your cash flows. You're surely not controlling the banking function. And I'm going to leave that bondage and go right into Babylon, jump right into a product like IUL. It's like there's a connection to me. Out of Egypt, onto Babylon. It's worth a read as well.
Casino theory, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
No. Nelson was he was all about that. You know, good stuff. Okay, James. It's good to catch up with you, man.
Same here, David.
Thank you for joining us on the Banking with Life podcast. If you're watching on YouTube, make sure to like and subscribe and click on that little notification bell. Otherwise, join us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher for weekly content.